Peter Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about
Episode 7 of New Scientist Christmas Edition, page 65, and this is about roundabouts, and I've just sort of find this in-depth information very interesting. Circular argument. They're safer, more efficient, and cut road pollution. So why do some people hate roundabouts so much, asks Richard Webb. Someone in a car with tinted windows, shlomming between lanes, pranged my bicycle back end on the Lambeth Bridge, southern roundabout in London. The wheel ended up slightly squashed, but there was no damage to life or limb. As an impoverished student, the £200 cash offered to sort myself out, no questions asked, came in quite handy. I mention this only because, in the very same roundabout, the iconic views of Big Ben and Parliament features in the notorious scene from the 1985 film National Lampoon's European Vacation. Clark Griswold, played by Chevy Chase, is on a family holiday in London and trying to desperately to exit. In failed attempts to manoeuvre his bright yellow rental car from the inside to the outside lane, he suffers near misses with other traffic. Night falls and the Griswolds are still circulating. Both scenes serve to transport us down a peculiar byway of technological progress, the vexed transatlantic history of the roundabout. This is a story to be entered cautiously, taking due note of already circulating traffic, and be warned, we may end up where we started. Roundabouts have this beautiful thing. Roundabouts have become part of street furniture in many parts of the world. They are good at what they do. According to the US Federal Highway Administration, FHWA administration, one-way gyratory system with a four-feeder road reduces severe crashes by, which is around about, 78% compared to crossroads controlled by traffic lights and 82% compared with one controlled by stop signs. There's two things, says Jeff Shaw of FWA. First, they reduce the speed to an intersection and they trade off right-hand crashes for crashes which are more merging, diverging type. I can vouch for that. It's the reason I still have ankles. That's right. Isn't that amazing? I do remember a picture, a Soviet propaganda picture of a big roundabout in front of a sanatorium in Leningrad, and the cars were there, and you realised that they had parked the cars, black cars, in position for the picture. Figures suggest that roundabouts are more efficient too, allowing a greater number of drivers through than a single intersection and reducing harmful exhaust emission from vehicles idling at the red light. Quote, it's really one of the great win-win in terms of both safety and ability to keep people moving, says Shaw. The UK certainly has taken to the roundabout with abandon. The concrete number is hard to come by. But a country that has something northwards of 25,000 of them, more than one every 16 kilometres of paved road. These include bewildering classics such as the swinging magic roundabout pictured below. My godfather. Oh my. Just. Wow. Oh, this. It's a roundabout with cars travelling two different directions on it. Oh my godfather. How can that be? I don't understand it. This car's travelling clockwise and anti-clockwise. So, you could... What? Oh, God. Whoa. Oh, this is my head in. This is not a real roundabout. It's sort of a roundabout with five mini road. Oh, God, that hurts my head. It's sort of a roundabout plus a normal road. I just can't. Oh, God, that really upsets me, even looking at it. There's actually five interlocking roundabouts arranged in a giant circle. It divides the travelling public in awe and fear. My God, it is actually. Oh, my God. Since 2003, the UK Roundabout Appreciation Society has even produced books, calendars, and assorted memorabilia featuring roundabouts with a particularly pleasing display in the middle. The lift-out trying tiring spirits on a long journey with their colours, the inventiveness, with whatever goes on a roundabout. This is Kevin Bradford, the Society's president. In 2019, the roundabout of the year is the Tour of Cornwall, and it features giant wooden sculpted hedgehogs pictured right. Oh my god, family, it is truly. For all the FWA's technocratic enthusiasm, such art is hard to find in the US, and yet the US was its pioneer. The world's first formal one-way gyratory system was probably Columbus Circle in New York, pictured above right, and built in 1870. My godfather. Many other grand-scale rotaries were built in the US in the following decades, says traffic engineer Lee Rodgertz. My godfather, the Swindon one is just... Oh, God, I should write to my UK person. Our Gibson Associates, Portland, Oregon, who is an international authority on roundabouts and keeps a database of those in the US and elsewhere. So what has changed? What happens in circular intersection fell out of favour here as a lot more automobiles ownerships took over, says Roger Gertz. Early roundabouts also had a simple but fatal flaw. Traffic entering them had priority. This is still the case in some corners of Europe. My God, and sets, which is not here, there's traffic. You have to give way to your right in an Australian roundabout. So, yeah, you don't give way to your left. Well, I don't know what's here. And this is still the case in some corners of Europe and set up a natural conflict with already circulating traffics. That's solved by a lot of weaving. As traffic speeds and volume increase, the size of roundabouts will increase to allow more space for this weaving, which in turn encourages higher speed and so on. It kind of fed itself, said Rogers, which is basically a dead-end solution. The answer came in 1966 with the iconoclastic British engineer called Frank Blackmore at the UK's Transport Research Laboratory. It seems obvious now. You reverse priority to make entering traffic yield to circulating traffic and gently curve the approaches to the roundabout to make traffic slow down. The principle could be made to work on intersections of all sizes. It led Blackmore to pioneer a further innovation, the mini roundabout. It's such a simple invention, isn't it? Says Beriford. A just painted blob in the middle of the road. It's incredible and cheap and works fantastically as well as opposed to traffic lights. It wasn't immediately obvious. Blackmore is said to have stood the middle on the first of the new roundabouts in Peterborough and personally directed traffic movements. But his concept has since conquered large parts of the world. Australia now has 10,000 modern-style roundabouts of all sizes. France has taken to them with a particular alien leading the world with an estimated 32,000. The US, meanwhile, has been an alternative route of splendid isolation, with more space to play with and fewer of the fiddly, irregular intersections of the old world, fell in love with the simple control junctions. You basically developed a mindset over generations of engineers to start with stop-controlled intersections, and if it doesn't work, you go to traffic lights, said Rockets. It took a man with tunnel vision determination to change things. Impressed with what he had seen in Europe, in 1986, the US engineer Leif Ostrand enlisted Blackmore's help to reintroduce the roundabout to the US soil. In 1941, when Sir Winston Churchill asked Americans to join Britain in a struggle to protect democracy, he wrote in a letter to Blackmore, "We joined you and together we triumphed. Now, 45 years later, I'm calling you upon you to help me with a difficult struggle in which we are both engaged. We're trying to bring the British-style roundabout into Western Hemisphere." The pair toured California, attempting to sell the concept, but to little avail. The transportation departments refused to believe that they could be safer. Fire departments warned that there would be an obstacle for emergency vehicles. Most of all, polls showed that roundabouts' underlying principle, yielding passage to circulating vehicles, smoothing according to your own judgment, rather than following a stop sign of a traffic light, made public angry and confused. Orson's big break came in 1990 with the permission to build two Blackmore-style roundabouts in a new development in Las Vegas Valley. That and the other pioneering examples started to prove that roundabouts could operate safely and improve traffic flows. In 1996, Rod Dirtz, then a rookie engineer, was invited to produce the first guide to roundabout design, FHWA. Part of the task in promoting a wide adoption of roundabouts in the US is to overcome the innate conservatism of engineers here, says Rodgers. They want to have something that's proven. They need to see it with their own eyes to believe it. Then there's a lingering public scepticism. One of the first things we tend to hear is that people don't know how to yield in my community, says Shaw. Still, the idea is catching on. In recent years, more state and local governments keen to build roundabouts have started to approach the FWH for help convincing their sceptical voters. One response has been to institute a national roundabout weeks in which the roundabout friendly take their social media to share positive experiences. The second one was held in September 2019. Quote, let the people kind of absorb it, you know, in a general sense, just to hear more about them and to learn more about them. From just a few hundred, maybe a decade ago, Rodriguez's numbers suggest something like 5,000 roundabouts are now spread across the US. He's cautiously optimistic things are turning the corner. Quote, it's a very uneven, some areas are still much more roundabout accepting than others, he says. Round and round it goes. The US capital of roundabouts is Carmel, Indiana, which has more than 100, and proudly bangs the drum for their introduction. About 20% of the states now have a policy for looking to see whether a roundabout might be the best solution for intersections, says Rodriguez, and often they find they are. The irony is that in the UK, things are starting to turn the other way. Increased traffic has encouraged the building of even bigger multi-lane roundabouts that are an obstacle to pedestrians and more dangerous to cyclists. In some circles, a movement away from roundabouts is seen as a way to break the tyranny of the motor car. Increasingly, too, high traffic volumes have undermined the whole free-flowing point of a roundabout, forcing planners to introduce traffic signals on roundabouts so that continuous circulating traffic doesn't stop people ever getting on. Or indeed, if Clark Griswold's trails on Lambeth Roundabout exemplified the US-Bermuda's relationship with the concept 3 decades ago, they have proved an unexpected boon for the pro-roundabout faction today. Any time there's a Facebook page dedicated to proposed roundabout, it's almost a given that somebody will post a GIF of the scene from that movie. This is sure. We've been able to turn that around with a great talking point and say, you know what? That is not what we're building. The notoriety seems to have stung someone in London too. Transport for London, the body responsible for the city's key junctions, has plans to replace the Lambeth roundabout with a four-way signalled intersection. Isn't that nice to see? So that's interesting about roundabouts and the safety, more safety and fuel efficiency, and we're getting our first roundabout in Glenbrook. Flying on entry. It sounds like steampunk fantasy, but we may finally have the technology to get the vacuum airships off the ground. Oh my god. In 1670, Francesco Lana, a Jesuit mathematician from Brescia, published a small volume describing his various investments, including a chapter including demonstration of feasibility of connecting a ship with rudder and ladders that will sail through the air. A sketch showed what it would look like, a typical wooden sailing boat, except the vessel would be suspended below 4 copper spheres, each containing vacuum that, being lighter than air, would provide lift. The idea didn't fly. No one could make spheres with walls as thin little calculator it would need, and in any case, they would have collapsed from the external pressure as soon as they were evacuated. Maybe Lara was onto something. There is now a renewed interest in his vision of sailing through the clouds, borne aloft by nothing, and at the same time we might be have an engineering solution to get them off the ground. Airships have already graced the skies, of course. The earliest one features simple balloons filled with hydrogen. The heyday came in the 1920s with a familiar elongated Zeppelin carried passengers across the Atlantic, the lap of luxury, and the gondola of the LZ-127 Graf Zeppelin. Four instance featured a dining room and cabins with a bed. The Golden Age ended abruptly in 37 with the Hindenburg disaster, and 36 passengers died when the Zeppelin caught fire. But the dream of travelling by such elegant airborne means has never faded. Airships have several advantages over the jet aircraft. They're greener, for starters, because they don't need much less fuel. Their propellers might even be solar powered. They don't need runways because they can take off vertically almost anywhere. You become like a ship in an ocean, but the port that exists in any place, says Igor Pasmak, founder of Worldwide Aeros Corp, a company based in California that is developing commercial rigid shell helium air ships for freight transport. Pasternak isn't alone in betting on helium airship. French company Flying Whales is developing them for cargo transport. Another firms are working on hybrid airships that incorporate components from winged aircraft helicopters to achieve lift from both buoyancy and aerodynamics. The trouble is the Earth's helium supply is a dwindling, and the age and the gas is too expensive to make airship viable on a large scale, says Julian Hunt, the International Institute of Applied Systems Analysis in Luxembourg, Austria. Not Luxembourg, but Luxembourg. Unfortunately, you can imagine it's like occasionally we get letters addressed to somewhere in Austria and it comes out to Australia. What's more, maintenance gets very complicated, says Bramsett, because you need a system to control the ballast. Unloading cargo from an airship, for example, creates a lift that must be counteracted by removing and recompressing some helium. That requires devices like valves and pressurized storage compartments. And more moving parts there are, the more to go wrong. There's no such problem with a vacuum. I can just open my valve and let air in to balance the pressure out inside. And if I want to fly, I just start pumping the air out again. You can create a lift at any moment. As a result, Paz believes that if we can get vacuum-based vessels aloft, that'll make cargo airships absolutely practical and effectively inexpensive. Yeah. I mean, it's... I'm just really trying to think this out. Well, let's see what they have to say. I've just got mental problems with this all. There is a problem, though. Without anything inside the airship shell, the air pressure is enormous. Today's materials make a shell strong enough to resist compression will end up so heavy that the vacuum inside will unable to lift it. Hunt speculates that light yet suspending carbon-based materials like graphene and carbon nanotubes could overcome the difficulty. Yeah, I'm just really trying to mentally... Ultimately, I just wonder whether you could actually make lighter than air carbon, you know, a buggyball so big. So, like, the actual buggyball big enough for how much it would be. Bendit's working on a doctorate in Massachusetts Institute of Technology Center for Bits and Atoms, has another solution, and has already made progress towards it. Jennett has devised lightweight lattice materials with tiny rod-like struts that are assembled into frameworks with tremendous stiffness and strength. This is the same principle that is behind the familiar triangular truss structures in cranes at the Eiffel Tower. Jennett struts are linked to form octahedral units with eight triangular faces that can be assembled into extended lattices. They are extremely light without sacrificing strength. A 10-centimetre cube with a lattice material weighs under 6 grams, about as much as a small strawberry. What's more, she generally believes that the Canatha Roboros assembly process can be simplified by using small robots that climb over the framework and put each piece in place. Jenna has sketched out how to make a shell of vacuum airship from a material like this, working with Christine Greek, Kenneth Ching of NASA's Ames Research Center in California. Jenna calculates that even with currently available materials, a shell with thickness of 1/10 the radius of the sphere it contains should be able to withstand air pressure without buckling. I think I've got a problem with the scale there, obviously. Yeah, I just find that scale thing hard to... I'm sure there's a scale. The scale things are Reynolds numbers and all that type of stuff. We also need for to become thin, impenetrable skin covering the latticework shell, which would add a bit of its weight, but not enough to invalidate the findings. A proof of concept prototype of at least a portion of this structure is in the works, says Jennings. The challenge is less severe if you create a vacuum only once the airship has reached high altitude, where the pressure is lower. In that case, Jennings suggests, the initial lift could come from hot air, heated by sunlight. The buoyancy would decline as the central air pressure diminishes, but the air would be pumped out of the airship's vacuum compartment that generated for the lift. And operating, this is where I think it could operate. It's sort of like, it's like a boat compared to a submarine, it would crush. I don't understand this. This isn't just a sketchbook dream. Jennet and his collaborators are in discussion with an aeronautical company, Aura Flight Sciences, recently acquired by Boeing, which is interested in developing vacuum balloons for atmospheric satellites. NASA is considering the lightweight lattice material for space-based solar arrays and telescopes, and for making pressurized shells for near-vacuum conditions outside that could be quickly assembled by robots in human space settlements. But the thoughts of vacuum airships are in the air. The nascent Italian company called U-Boot has drawn up ambitious plans, though at this point they aren't much more than that. The firm's hybrid design would allow it to achieve vertical takeoff via its wings and helicopter-like propellers, or using helium that is gradually compressed as the airship rises. And that would actually make sense. But, and then again, what's the advantage of doing that? I don't quite understand that. As external air pressure decreases, the vacuum balloons will be emptied more to lighten the load of the wings, which higher altitudes, I suppose. Levico Tibet propulsion would come from solar-powered electrical motors soaking up sunlight as well as above the cloud layer. One way or another, the age of the airship will return, so I suppose the question is when. The market for freight transport is clear. A fleet of small, cheap airships could make deliveries straight from factories without any need for warehouse storage. If you can establish carbon-neutral air infrastructure for moving materials and goods, it could be a significant benefit to the environment. This is just complete wank, unfortunately. Now, what about passenger travel? Airships have always been slow compared to jet aeroplanes, so it's hard to see them working on long-distance travel. Press, unless a leisurely luxury journey is the whole point. For short trips, though, the speed would be competitive. People don't tend to fly for journeys of a few hundred kilometres. The competition is then with trains and cars, which are generally no faster. Airships would be ideal for hopping between islands too, replacing ferries. And let's be honest, who wouldn't be tempted for a chance to travel in a gondola hanging off thousands of metres over the ground, borne aloft nothing... By nothing. Or, yeah, I just find that hard to pattern. Let me just check the time here. 23 minutes. Okay, Winter Wonderland. It may appear cold and empty, but snow is teeming with life. Claire Answorth dives in for a closer look. That's interesting. Sean Brown's field trip got off to a bad start when he discovered that his experiment had disappeared. He had travelled thousands of kilometres from the University of Memphis to Finland to study the blood-red snow algae when a heat wave had turned his plants to mush. The sun had melted the dark red living patches, and now only white snow remained. With funders to satisfy, Brown and his team stuck plan B. Looked for algae in the pristine white snow. Didn't expect to find much, but their surprise was discovered a rich hidden ecosystem of algae, fungi and bacteria. I was just blown away by the biodiversity, says Brown. Until recently, microbes in snow were assumed to be rare and largely inactive. It is only in the past couple of years that scientists, including Brown, have used state-of-the-art DNA sequencing technology to reveal a secret life hidden there. As we learn more, it's becoming apparent that this is not a new curiosity. Snow microbes may play a role in cycling nutrients and carbon. They can be tiny, but given the snow covers a third of the land on Earth, they could have overlooked impact on the planet's health and climate. That's interesting. It may seem improbable that life could survive among ice crystals, given the dependence of liquid water, but microbes have evolved ingenious ways of eking out a living in snow. They grow in watery veins that run through the snowpack, melted either by impurities or by proteins that the microbes make. In extremely cold environments, some microbes slow their metabolism down to such a crawl that they can take hundreds of years to survive. Others might tick over in snow and then become active during the thaw. They're just guessing at this point, says Brown. We don't really know how they're making a living. And we're starting to understand that they come from, though, some simply fall from the sky, swept from the Earth's surface and carried on the winds to destinations. Some create the snow itself, acting seeding points in clouds on which freezing water can take hold and grow into snowflakes. Others may simply lie low in the soil, biding their time, says Brown. When the blanket of snow triggers a fleeting, invisible blossoming of specialist microbes, such as grass seed, just as a grass seed in a desert briefly springs into life when the rain comes, even freshly fallen snow in your back garden has life lurking in it. To explore the composition of these frigid ecosystems, Brown and his colleagues collected snow from different latitudes, Finland, Norway, Sweden, as well as Colorado, and applied a technique called next-generation DNA sequencing, which let them study the organism's presence without having to grow them, by looking at microbial genes in each sample. They found intriguing differences amongst the various types of microbes. Bacteria were pretty much the same everywhere in Europe, although different from the US, but the fungal species tended to stick to their own neighbourhoods. That makes sense because bacteria are much smaller than fungi. And so, would more readily hitch a lift in the wind. The algae were more surprising. Being relatively large, so harder to disperse, you might expect geographically distant populations to comprise distinct combination of species. However, they were remarkably similar when comparing the sites of Europe and the US, with one species dominating. Apparently, similarity suggests that the algae are highly adapted to living in the snow, says Brown. They may have had little pressure to change. Brown has been studying the temperate latitudes where snow is ephemeral, secret gardens that flower in winter and dissolve in spring. Things are different in permanently frozen regions of snow that persist year on year, like Antarctica. In 2012, a project began to drill through the glacier in western Antarctica to reach a lake that lay entombed beneath it and look for possible life cut off from the surface half a million years. Before the drilling began, David Pearce at Northumbria University and his team were asked to survey the snow in the vicinity of the drill site to find out what microbes lived there as a precaution against contamination. Pearce is also keen to discover the same species lived across Antarctica, or whether there were local variations. So the researchers shouldered sterilized shovels and began digging a range of locations with different types of snow, including islands of North Atlantica at Antarctica, peninsula, and various sites of continental interior. They found different communities of microbes at different areas. Some bacteria matched those known to exist in other parts of the world, but there were also some that seemed to be unique to Antarctica. The major concern for the Antarctic scientists is biocontamination, bringing microbes from elsewhere in the world or moving around those already present. In this regard, Pearce is finding it reassuring because there is no evidence that humans had introduced any microbes. Yet, they also indicate that intense activity could be accidentally change the natural balance of species. Pierce suggests that there should be no-go zones in areas of special scientific interest until we understand the ecosystems better. Quote, we don't know enough about the diversity of the Antarctic microbial flora to know if we go somewhere and do something, we're not upsetting the environment, he says. Microbes all around. What we do know is that snow microbes aren't inert. Quote, everywhere we look, we find microbes, and they're active, and they are involved in biogeochemical cycling, climate active gas production, says Pierce. In other words, the snow microbes play a part in a process that are crucial for maintaining the healthy biosphere of Earth. For example, his team found that snow taken from the Arctic and Antarctic harbored microbes that were consuming chemicals they know as methyl hydrides, which degrade ozone in the atmosphere and affect the breakdown of atmospheric gases such as greenhouse gas and methane. Exactly how snow microbes affect the Earth's climate is unknown. For now, their metabolism is very slow because of the extreme cold, says Pierce, but the sheer volume of snow on Earth suggests that they could make a significant contribution to the overall story. Even as scientists start to explore life, its future is under threat from global warming. Snow is melting earlier in the season in some parts of the world, and other areas get more snow than they once did. All this will have unknown effects on snow microbes and the processes they might involve in. Quote, there's certainly a lot of new life and new biodiversity which is described in these systems, says Brown. Quote, we just don't know enough about them to know what we're going to lose. Sort of rather strange and apocalyptic. That's Claire Ainsworth. And your next things is The Secret Life of Truffles. We'll talk about that a bit later.
Another podcast, another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.